are listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
Hello, this is Shante Marsh. Welcome to another episode of Create Here. Today we're joined by artist LaShonda Crowstorm, who has just opened an exhibit with us at Tube Factory Art Space in the main gallery called Sister Song, The Requiem. LaShonda is a mixed media and community-based artist, activist, community builder, and occasionally an urban farmer. Whether making artwork or sowing seeds, she uses her creative power as a vehicle for dialogue around topics such as racial and gender violence, social change and justice. At the core of her practice is a desire to create community, any community in which the process of making art creates a space for difficult discussions with an eye towards community healing. She has received numerous awards for art and community activism. Crowstorm received an MFA from the School of Art Institute of Chicago in 2004. And we want to thank our funders of this exhibit. It was made possible by Mr. and Mrs. Craig E. Von Dalen and Laura S. Judkins. And it was made possible by the DeHaan Artist of Distinction Award, with additional support from the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Arts Council of Indianapolis, and the City of Indianapolis. LaShonda, thank you so much for doing this with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And I love to talk to you.
Oh, I love talking to you. I am a longtime fan of your work, and we've worked together on several shows. And do you want to, this is the Requiem of Sister Song, mm-hmm. but do you want to describe to the audience what it is they would be looking at when they come into the gallery?
Yeah. So as a community-based effort, this work really looks at how do we address these histories that happen to Black women's bodies in the Americas through enslavement, which oftentimes meant a lot of violence and abuse, a lot of that being sexual violence. And how do we heal these histories? As we know, a history is never past. It is always with us, and it transforms and has different ramifications moving forward. So in one of my mixed media hats, I'm actually trained as a caster, a bronze caster. And so in doing this work, I think it's important to even back it up even further, that the actual impetus begins probably about 2003, between 2002 and 2004, when I was at the Art Institute. One of my signature projects, the Lynch Quilt Projects, which uses quilting as a vehicle to address racial violence, specifically lynching, was launched then. But this particular project was also conceived then in a different way, in that it is in my sketchbook right alongside the creation of the quilt. So you actually see the beginnings of this project get born. It just took this long for me to figure out how do you go from that idea that's in the sketchbook to what we have today. And some of that was really working through the Lynch Quilt Project, where my own honing my skills on how do you do community-based practices, where you are working with community, whether they're artists or they're just folks who don't consider themselves artists, in a co-creative process. And that means that the processes are just longer to do that work. So fast forward, I want to say it was the exhibit we did in 2017, Keeper of My Mother's Dream, where I was working on a different project called Origins that Big Car commissioned me to create for that exhibit, that actual piece itself, which is the bronze casting on of African American woman's pelvis. That too was conceived in the exact same sketchbook with the Lynch Quilt Project. So there are many ways Sister Song, the Lynch Quilt Project, and Origins are all linked to these histories, really exploring how do we heal them in a communal fashion. So while working on Origins, you know, if you make any kind of metal, you know, there's huge periods of time where you're not doing anything because you're waiting for stuff to dry. And I was like, oh, well, let me go work on this, because I had back in 2002, 2003, actually made the mold for what has become Sister Song. So I've had this mold with me for 20 years at this point.
Wow.
That, you know, 15, 20, yeah, I can't count. So all of you math
almost
people
20.
Out there.
Almost wanna, 20.
I had it with me and I was just like, well, I had originally thought of them being in porcelain slip. And as I was looking at the mold itself, I was like, oh, well no, I want to do something different. Mm-hmm. And started making them in wax. And I love wax because wax is a material where you can add and subtract and cut from it and reform it. You can do anything you want to wax until you turn it into metal. And you can't really do that with slip, but it was the ceramic slip. It was the same idea about how do we take this thing, and if you can't see me, I have that in quotes, this thing, which is the Black woman's womb, which was turned into literally a commodity, because that's where her wealth was in her ability to birth babies. How do you turn this thing that has been removed from all forms of creation and the sacredness of that act of making and turn it into a commodity to build entire nations of the Western Hemisphere? We're talking about almost every single country in the quote-unquote Western Hemisphere is impacted by these processes of bringing people to another country and commodifying their wombs and making people. But I'm going to really stick to America because this is where I'm at, and this is where I have to heal those histories. People in other places have to figure out what makes sense for them. But metal is precious, and so that made sense, and metal is much more malleable. But as is the case, I started making them and casting them. I had all these wax wombs, and I got stuck. And a friend of mine who was like, oh, and it's funny, I just love her because she was my student when I was a graduate student. She was my student. And then when she graduated, we became friends. She was like, I just don't understand, because you're a community-based artists and you always find a way to bring others with you. How is it that you're going to tackle really hard and big, horrible histories alone? You always are like, no, everybody has to help. And I was like, oh, I totally forgot my own root playing with this thing, because the objects itself is beautiful, especially in the wax. Wax is beautiful. And it just made sense. And so as the wombs come out of the mold, the wax mold, they then get altered and modified. It's funny because I'll have to go back and find it, but I have whole things where whatever I made that day, it literally, they sung their own way. So I have all these writings about the ones that were made that day, because, you know, you pour, I only have the one mold because that's all I made, and I never made another one because I thought it was kind of odd, and there will come a time when that mold maybe gets decommissioned or destroyed or something, and that's the end of the process, and that's fine.
Because it's giving birth itself many times.
That is worn out. and maybe the mold itself becomes its own art object. I don't know. I just know there will come a time when that mold has to be retired.
And the other thing I noticed, too, like, all the wombs are different.
They are. They were altered in the wax state first. And then we have to take them through the process using what's called the lost cast, the lost wax casting process, and turn them into metal. And at that point, but what used to happen is I would sing to them and dance to them and write all kinds of stuff about the collection that was made that day, which over a 5 hour period might get two or three, because you have to boil the wax, put it in there, let it cool off, let it do its thing. So you might get like maybe up to five, because mm-hmm. I'd be in there playing with them, but I'd be singing to them and dancing to them. And then after they get turned into metal, photograph them all and invite community. Some of the original womb makers, we did the project in 2017 with Keeper of My Mother's Dream, which was another exhibit. And we had eight womb makers then. Fast forward, each of those womb makers was invited to invite another person that they felt that they would work with to really explore these histories. And then I had a whole, it's complicated, but I have a running list of folks to invite into the project that I found along the way. And you'd ask, and some people, they would take the womb and be like, okay, this is just getting to be too much, as I have to really think about these questions, like, what are these histories? How am I connected to them, and how do I heal them? So they would come back. Mm-hmm. Some folks weren't artists, so I was their hands, and we became teaching artists, and we'd really go through the process of how do you want to talk about this history, and what does it look like when it becomes into the womb? And so we go back and forth. Some of the individuals invited by the original line of womb makers, that womb maker worked with them, or it would be a three-way collaborative on that particular womb. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the womb maker would be like, here's the person, but you go work with them.
Yeah.
Because that process of trying to be the intermediary and the teaching artist, that just wasn't their skill set. So it took probably about 18 months. From start to finish, some of the wombs took longer because, as you can imagine, when you understand the histories, you understand what the reality is now and the high levels of sexual trauma and abuse that's within the African-American community for women itself. Some people were triggered. And so it was my responsibility to walk alongside them for that time period to work through the trauma that gets triggered by creating of the womb through the actual creation of the womb itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so each womb is different, and they're different because when they were made, it's the rare womb that wasn't modified out of the wax. And then they get transformed yet again. So there are all kinds of shapes and textures and interpretations of what it means to address these histories and how do we heal them. So together they become one song. I guess you can think about it. I call them womb songs now.
Mm-hmm.
With this project, there is a commissioned poet named Maria Hamilton Abigunde. And so I make the art. The community makes the art. Then she makes poetry to go with it, and they are one. So we have an altar space for people to meditate and read the poetry. Also integral to this work is actually giving space for those who visit to provide their own discussions of these histories. So all told, that becomes the piece, the community interaction, the poetry, and the actual wombs themselves. And we have 47 wombs, 49 art pieces and 47 wombs. And I did make a womb, because people always ask me this. Did you make some of the wombs yourself? And I'm like, well, yes. But I took all the wombs that kind of got left behind, that community and artists didn't select them or choose them or left behind. Different words make people react differently. Like, don't say they were just forgotten wombs. I'm like, but they kind of were. People like, oh, I don't want that one. And so, or they would come back. I had a couple just get mailed back. And I was like, I knew mm-hmm. who they had went to, and they just came back.
Mm-hmm.
So I took all of those that were left behind, and those are the wombs that I transformed.
Can you talk a bit about, because it's interesting, can you talk a bit about the concept of healing in relation mm-hmm. to these works and how that's, you know, I'll let you talk about it because
yeah.
you really made me think on it, you know, what my whole idea of healing was versus what you were saying about it.
Yeah, I think that rooted in my own faith traditions, which are rooted in West African practices, that we kind of get these ideas that healing is pretty and that you come to the end and you're like happy-go-lucky. And that's actually not always the case. It can be a struggle because people have to sit and confront and look at things that maybe they've never looked at before in different ways. And definitely through this process, using more kind of narrative therapy techniques where you just ask questions and allow people to walk through the questions, that if you've never been asked a question about what does it mean, what are these histories, how do they impact me, and how do I take responsibility and heal them, then what that looks like is going to be different for everyone, because how they enter that journey is going to be different. So for some people, it was about really thinking about that despite that history, her mother was a sharecropper and picking cotton and was only 5 foot tall. And despite all of that Jim Crow South that they were in, that they created a home full of love and children, and that this woman at 5 feet gave birth to 15 children and held it down picking cotton every day. And so for her, that was that understanding, that healing, that we couldn't change that history. But the healing itself came from being able to, despite her hard circumstances, building a home where there was love and abundance. Mm-hmm. And so for other people, it did become having to confront their own histories about sexual abuse that has happened to them.
Yeah.
For others, it became looking at how has their own faith tradition, whatever it is, Catholic, atheist, whatever, has that process been the thing that has helped them through the hard times? And what does it mean? Mm-hmm. So healing doesn't look the same for everyone. I think we live in a society that, especially if you come through a lot of the more kind of Western Abrahamic traditions, that is like, here is the way forward a lot of times. And when you come from different perspectives around faith, it's like, well, what is your faith journey looks like? Because we could look the same, have the same whatever, but my journey forward and your journey forward aren't the same. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that one is less valid than the other. It's just like, this is the route you've got to go. And so in this project, we create that space. We just ask the question,
right,
and then follow the lines of how people have to go. And it's not always pretty. It's not always easy. One way I have a mentor is like, well, you know, sometimes my job is to come and pull the scab off and to let the what festers inside bleed so that the infection and the trauma can get out. And that's another way to look at it. But what that looks like when individuals encounter it are different. But the goal is the same. Well, what does healing look like? And then that becomes, well, what healing look like for me? What are the tools that I work on? How do we heal community? What does it mean to heal community? What is my role in how we transform this? That those all become the ways in which that conversation gets to get had.
Yeah. I mean, like with that being said and thinking about healing, like, you know, some women, you know, our ancestors didn't even get the opportunity to consider healing, you know. So, mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what you're taking on with this project, too, right? Is like mm-hmm. some of us now have the ability to try, mm-hmm. you know, this generation and, you know, are we going to take it on or not?
Yep. And so definitely going again back to kind of a Ifa Orisha West African viewpoint, we the living are the bridge between the past and the future. And if we are willing to stand at that crossroad and do the hard work of healing, just this one person, if you're willing to do it, you can free your entire lineage afterwards. But I can't remember the exact quote, but it comes out of the book, The Salt Eaters. And in it, it goes, are you sure, sweetheart, that you want to be well? Because being well is not always fun and sugarcoated, because then you may have to restructure. As you restructure and you heal those wounds, you may look around and realize you have to have a different kind of life than the one you're living now. And then that's a different type of shift that has to happen. And I know with this project, and definitely with the work with the Lynch Quilt Project, I've been I don't know what the word is, honored, blessed. I don't know, put it, whatever word you need to put in there, to have the opportunity to bear witness to others being able to transform through that. And it's not always pretty and it's not always easy. And then when the actual wombs went up, you know, they like to talk to each other because it's one thing when they're in the house in different boxes. It's another thing when they're all out and they're like, hey, we're in the world and there's all my sisters over there. And then they shift the energy themselves. And that, you know, had an impact on some of the audience members that came to visit, as well as some of the womb makers. And so here became the next level of what that dialogue needed to be like for some individuals as that journey has continued.
Yeah, it's been, you know, there's two things that I was thinking about based off of what you just said. One thing is that you and I have long talked about and believed in, you know, that an ancestral memory stored in ourselves. And now there is scientific evidence that proves that that's a fact. The other thing I just want to relate this in a way to in this concept of healing. It's been weird to me with this exhibit. I had to put up signs because people wanted to touch the wombs and also felt entitled to. And I was like, that was weird to me because I wouldn't think to touch it. And it's not just because it's in a museum space, but it's like a sacred object. And then you think about the history you're talking about and, you know, how we are. You know, women are born with their eggs, you know, and their ovaries. And then it's just so they're like, I always say my daughter and my son have been with me from the moment I was born.
You and know, your
I was
granddaughter and your daughter, and your grandchildren are already in there.
Right. Yeah. So, can you talk a bit about that, you know, about maybe I'm trying to connect to many things, but
we'll just talk. So what's the question that you want me to talk about?
You know, just this idea, not everybody is familiar with ancestral memory and how that can tie into healing. And
so, you know, like, again, going back to my own framework, the reality is that when we give up these physical bodies, we're still here. Our souls and stuff is still here. And if you were traumatized in this life, just because you leave your body behind doesn't mean that trauma goes away. And so that trauma can get passed on again and again and again. And the question becomes, we, the living, the bridge between the past and the future, all possible futures. So will you stand within that trauma and heal it and be honest about what it means? And then understand what you're seeing before you within your own family, within your own community. Will you be honest and about what you're seeing and maybe how you've participated in perpetuation of some of those things and what you can do now to put an end to the perpetuation of those things? And sometimes all you can do is really focus on you, because it gets really easy to be like, okay, I'm going to go out and save everybody. No, you're not. But you can really focus on you. Mm-hmm. You can really, as Radical Dharma, Rev Angel Kyoto would say, mind your business and pay attention to how you are responding to something, and pay attention to how you're responding, but also what it means. But you can only do that if you're really going to have an honesty and put yourself within the context of your own history, the things you've been told, and then you're looking at the historical record and you're looking at the genetic record and you're just like, huh, some things don't make sense here.
Right.
And not to be angry about the people in the past, but to be like, what does this mean? And what does it mean for me to have to grapple with it? Mm-hmm. And those are hard places for people to be. Yeah. But they're good places to be sometimes if people are going to have the supports and things to walk through. And so here's this little bitty art project that has, for quite a few people, been a vehicle toward what that transformation and re-examination of who it means to be them and to find their own healing. That yeah. It's been a way forward.
You know, and another thing I really love about your work just overall, to me, you know, art is one of the redeeming things I find redeeming about humanity, you know, like it still gives me, like, I'll read the news and then I'm like, oh, and then I get to work with artists like you, and it makes me feel better about being human and humanity, that we can do something good. But then there's an expectation a lot of times for artists to commodify their work, to have their work for sale. And I like how you have flipped that here. We're like, none of these pieces are for sale. Mm-mm. Can you talk a bit, like, you know?
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit on that? And, you know, also I'm sure it's not always easy being an artist and not having work for sale.
Yeah. And so there's two things. I think we have to also think about how do other cultures outside of the Western tradition think about the arts and the role and function arts have in society and in humanity as a whole, that's beyond just it's a commodification. Because when we get trapped that way, then we make choices that maybe don't lead to this particular kind of project. And so a long time ago, I made the choice that I would find other ways to support myself as an individual, my own artwork, which means that I'm a really good grant writer. It means that sometimes I take on a second job just to fund a project. But for me, being able to create art that's a vehicle to transformation is the root of my practice. And I can't imagine things like any of those wombs just being sold as an individual thing, because they belong to each other. And when they're done, if they are ever sold someplace or donated, they would have to go together because they belong to each other.
Right.
And it would be so odd if one was like, you'd be like, what is that doing over there without her sisters? What is she doing over there?
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes those are the aspects of the choices that don't get talked about. And those are those choices I've made. Mm-hmm. And it's not always easy. I mean, I do artwork about lynching. People are not lining up at my door. Hey, come talk to me about that lynching. So I've found other ways to fund it, other ways to, and there are some places like the Puffin Foundation and things that specialize in supporting art that is not easily sold, that mm-hmm. doesn't exist for that purpose, that helps us move ourselves forward in understanding the role and function of the arts. I mean, this was funded by the DeHaan Foundation, Artists of Distinction Award, which is rooted in that. It wasn't really about, like, how you're going to be able to hustle this out and make some NFTs and things. It really was about how does this, doing this particular work, advance art mm-hmm. and our understanding of the role of art. So some of those things are just choices people have to make. And be happy with the choice you've made. Mm-hmm. So for me, I look over there, I'm like, I'm happy with the choice I've made. It doesn't mean that there aren't times you're just like, but for the most part, I'm happy with the choice I've made. I know that I've seen people before me heal. Just
right.
And there is I don't have the word. And I guess, you know, English is such a limiting language, in a language that only has one word for love. You have to question what's going on here. There
right.
are so many words for love, that what other words are we missing within the English language? Because I don't think honor, or I don't know what the word is, but to be able to bear witness to something like that, there is a awe-inspiring thing attached to it.
Yeah. And this work is not You're not done making these wombs, right? You have plans for more.
I do. We do plan. I have to take a break because it is a lot of emotional labor, and I've got another project I've got to get back to. Which, you know, it's like wombs, masquerade. They're all running around the house together, and I'm like, somebody needs to go over here and take a nap for a little bit. So these will take a nap, but there will be in probably about 2 more years. We'll circle back and begin that process again, but really focusing around men. Mm-hmm. When you understand these histories, you have to start. All those babies didn't arrive here on their own.
Right.
And the way those babies got here weren't always because women were happily participating in those processes. I'll just tell this story, but a fair-complected African-American male, he was making a joke about something, and I just asked him. I was like, well, so tell me this. How many of your mothers, for you to get that complexion, how many of your mothers were put on their backs against their will? Because that's how little light-skinned babies got made. And I was like, so when you're making these jokes, you ought to think about your great-great-great-grandmother and what she went through for you to end up here like this today. And you can't run from that because we want to say we're all this and we're all that. Well, a lot of this stuff didn't happen because of love. It happened because of a whole bunch of other stuff. So celebrate it, but be honest about what we're doing and what it means. Mm-hmm. And so that next step really is looking at, well, what does it mean? You as a male, men, or however you want to call it, holding this object, and I got that in quotes, that is the thing that brings forth all life, that is the universe, the power of creation right here, which you were born through. You didn't come out of a rib. You came out of this.
Right.
What does that mean to you? Especially when you look at the context of that history, then look at the context of what it means in our contemporary society and the levels of abuse. When we think about like 80,000 Black women and girls are missing, and people don't seem to know that fact that that's how many are missing and things like that. And it's not talked about, and it's just kind of like, well, so those are just things for, that's the next round. And so we'll work toward that. I have to think about what that means. I don't know what it means. I know there will be some invites. I don't know how many invites or if it means that I just have a list and I run with the list. Because if we continue down that particular road, then that means the 40-some-odd womb makers would invite somebody. And that means we'd have like 90 wombs this next round. So I'll just have to. And then there are definitely like a few like random women that still need to participate that for a variety of reasons couldn't this time, like just wrong timing for them, wrong that it was a lot emotionally at that time. And so since then they've walked through that journey and are like ready to go into basically what I call jumping off the abyss, and we'll see what happens. We will get to the bottom. I don't know what it means, but we're going to float down, and I'll float down with you. And just even for myself, like, what is the max number of people that I can be emotionally tied to during that time, walking through that journey? Because it'll be different for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, because the other thing about this show is that it's been a lot of work for you emotionally to provide the space and opportunity for healing for so many women involved in the project. How has that been for you?
Oh, it's been rough at some times. There are definitely and it's all over the map. It's the individual, it's the it's what happens as we go down the journey. But I was really kind of strategic by releasing a few at a time. So that the initial impact would start. But there's lots of, you're talking about hundreds of hours of of phone calls and being with people and walking through them, and in many ways just creating spaces for love and being cool with that. But you have to be wired a particular way to be okay with that, because it could be very easy, like, you go do this project and go on. Mm-hmm. And I don't, my own particular art practice is rooted in maybe spiritual and shamanic principles, where if you open the circle, you close the circle. So mm-hmm. if I go over there and poke at you and be like, hey, let's do this thing, then there's a part of me that has to be there with you as you go fool around and do this thing, whatever right. that is. And you don't know what it's going to be,
right?
Because even folks that look like they have it together, it may awaken in them something that they hadn't thought about in years.
Right.
And then some of the people you're like, okay, they're going to need some support. They're like, no, you know, this is the thing I was looking for. It's helped me move to another level. And you're like, oh, okay. But you just have to be open to the journey, the unexpectedness of what that journey means.
Yeah. And I mean, I've been around you, and you'll be like, wait, I got to make a phone call. I got to do a check on this person, mm-hmm. you know? And so, you know, I have had over, like, I can't remember what year we started working together, mm-hmm. but you're the only artist that I have shown multiple times.
Oh, thank you.
I usually just, you know, show an artist once because, you know, for several different reasons, mm-hmm. but I think that because of how community-based and healing-oriented your work is, mm-hmm. and how it's just been a continuation, it would be wrong to not continue this work with you, because I also selfishly want to see
And I'll be honest, it would seem odd if I didn't continue with you. Yeah. Honestly, I'm just like, oh, this is my artistic spiritual home. What are you talking about? That we can go over there and do all the things. Because, you know, it's not just the exhibit and all the stuff that goes with it, the exhibit, the poetry, it's also the community events that we try out. And I don't think there's not a lot of places willing to commit to the community in that way through an artistic process. So, you know, thank you for walking the journey. But part of me is like, what she means she wouldn't walk that journey with me? Of course, she's coming with me.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. Each time we've shown together, there are a series of events mm-hmm. that you put together and arrange. So it's not just getting the exhibit up. There are events to help the community process the mm-hmm. work, which I love so much about that opportunity. Like I said, sometimes I think people, because they walk into your show and it's difficult, you know, because it's asking not just for the individual artist who's worked on these wombs to heal, but it's really asking also the community heal by witnessing it. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? So sometimes people, they have a hard time with your work and they get angry, or they don't understand that it's not about shock or mm-hmm. you know, this is about healing and helping mm-hmm. people love themselves and, you know, connect to each other a little better, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, we'll see. Like, it varies, but can you talk a bit about that? Like, how that
The reality is we also get shocked, and I'm putting that in quotes, because these aren't stories we talk about, because they're things that we would rather choose not to exist or definitely not give any credit to. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes another thing where you're just like, well, whether you like it or not, lynching happened. Whether you like it or not, systematic structural rape of women happened. And it's not like it gets removed just because you want to look the other way now. And so you have an option to confront those histories and honor the histories of what it meant and what it meant for to happen to people. Or you can choose to get angry versus being like, oh, this is a bad history. How do we ensure it never happens again? And how do we create spaces where our communities can heal from this? Mm-hmm. So the response says a lot for about people as well. And you have to, I think if you do this work, you have to, again, that idea that healing, everyone's journey toward healing isn't the same. I think we live in McDonald land society where we're just like, it's all the same, and it's not. And it might be, this is not for you. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That's okay. I'm okay with that. And I think people are oftentimes very like shocked. I'm like, oh, okay, you know, then this may not be for you. Or go around and look, and it's okay that this is not for you. And I think we get so trapped in this idea that things have to be for everyone, and everything isn't for everyone. You might come in there and be like, oh, that's not my way forward. And I'm like, you know what? That's good that you know that. Go find your way forward and attach yourself to it and do it. Then you'll see people that in one incident, woman had quite a bit of mental health services, this and that. That is not the thing that helped her deal with her childhood of abuse. It was working on this project. And you're sitting there and you're listening to the stories about all the things that happened to her for years and all the, you know, the services and things. And none of that worked because those were not the ways forward in which she needed. But she runs into this project. And this is the thing after decades. That is the thing that helps to start. And I'm not going to say that it's like a silver bullet, but you can see from even her own words how there is this shift and how she's starting to rethink what her next steps can be and how she can move beyond those histories that happened to her personally. And it wasn't mental health services. It wasn't group this. It wasn't any of those things. It wasn't lawsuits. It wasn't that. It literally was the little art project that could, because it gave a different on-ramp into thinking about how do I heal from this history? And unfortunately, we've got to get back to thinking, stop this idea that everything has to fit for everyone, because it's not. There are very few things that fit for everyone. Water, air, food, and even the kind of food you want to eat is different. But outside of water and air and sleep and food, what human beings need are different. Mm-hmm. And it's okay if you walk in and are like, you know, this isn't for me. Okay. Go in and enjoy it for the beautiful factor and then move on. Leave your story about women that have been important to you. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And we have, I think, in a society that's all about IG, me, all of that, this idea of learning how to stand and bear witness, people have forgotten, because then it always becomes you'll walk into a space, and I've seen this happen, not just here, but in some of my community-based work. Well, if it would be like this, then I would participate. And I'm always like, so here's the question. Why does it have to adjust itself to fit your needs versus you understanding that maybe at this time it is your job to learn to bear witness to a thing?
Yeah.
To ensure that others know that things exist that may be for them. But instead it becomes, let me come in and change everything so that it fits me. And we have to really get back to learning what it means to bear witness. You hear all these terms about being an ally and this and that, and you're like, well, you do know that means that you have to learn to bear witness, but that's not really what I see you doing. I see you coming in, and rather as we're trying to find food or housing or whatever, that your initial, a lot of initial response is to attack and make it something different versus being like, what is this thing? How do I honor what it is in that moment? And maybe it is for me, maybe it's not for me. Maybe I can take something from seeing how this operates and take it to my own community. And maybe I just am there to bear witness that here's this other way of being in the world, and then I move on. And I think that's really hard for people, especially in I just call it IG me in this society where everything is about, I pooped this many times today and let me put it out on social media, that this kind of hyper focus on the individual means that sometimes we forget what it means to be a part of the collective and what it means to hold space for others. Even if the holding space for others means you don't get to, that it's not your job to benefit from it. It's your job to hold the space so that others can transform. And I think those are just things that have been forgotten, and they've got or I won't even say they're forgotten, because I know, I mean, you do it. I know people who do it, but the vast majority of society is IG me that I encounter. And there is a quote unquote sacredness of building a container for others to grow and evolve. There is a sacredness to that. I guess, that's where I'm going to end that. Because I could go all off into a million directions, because that's where I was headed off into, with Luke Leia in the galaxy far, far away. But we'll come back to here at WQRT.
What you're also talking about, that you have allowed us all who have been part of it even to bear witness, is a reclamation of power and space. Mm-hmm. And you accompanied that by also collecting the stories that each woman had, mm-hmm. and with the womb that they took on in their bios. So, you know, can you talk to us a bit about that?
Yeah, because, you know, it's a super collaborative. That really is. It's a super collaborative. But the container that becomes the requiem, other people help build that, too. And to not honor all those voices, all the things, all the energies, the passions, the sorrows, the loves, the joys, the anger, whatever. To not honor that just seems wrong. It would never occur to me to enter into this particular type of journey and not be like, okay, now, you know, this is one, and let's hear all the stories, because all those stories are the artwork itself. All that is in the birdcage where people are leaving behind things, because the things they're asked to be left behind aren't, oh, good job. They are, leave me a story about the women who've impacted you. Leave me poetry about them. And that's because how often are we given the opportunity to uplift and honor other people, like actively asked to do it?
Yeah.
And so all of that together becomes sister song. So that is the container. That's the womb of the project in many ways, that they all live within there. All these poetry and 47. I mean, it's like a multiple birth in there, like a super multiple birth in there.
Well, maybe we should read the names of.
Oh, yeah. I don't have on my glasses. I can't read that.
I'm afraid of pronunciation.
Let me see if I can find my glasses real quick.
See if you can find your glasses. I do want to say, just a womb I've been drawn to over and over again is Alice Berry's womb.
Okay. You want to talk about why?
I don't know. I think I'm drawn to it over and over again because I don't know why, and I have to figure it out.
Okay.
You know, that's always like how I work as a curator is when I want to work with an artist, it's because there's something about their work that punched me in the gut. Mm-hmm. It's very emotion-based. Mm-hmm. But then what I try to do is work backwards and figure out why. And, you know, because you have to be able to explain it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm always, like, thinking, how can I... sometimes I have to figure out why. Like, why is this... Why did this impact me? Is it just me? Is it because there is a universal message to the work? Mm-hmm. Is it both? You know, and I think with that piece, I'm still figuring that out.
Ooh, I can't wait till you figure it out, because we're going to have coffee over this one. But with that being said, I have found my glasses. And so this time our participating womb makers include Abe Gunde, who is also the commissioned poet, Afrié We Can Do This, Alice Berry, Ariana Beatty, Bambi Aldridge, Breon Tyler, Claire Wildhack Nolan with Esme Wildhack Kane, D. Olivia Jones, Joyce Moore, Waquita Calloway, Julia Rodriguez, Keisha Dixon, Kianga Janaki, Latoya Marlin, Lilis Taylor, Maleka Boxa, Marilyn Michelle Kunkel, Melissa Larimer, Monica Johnson, Njai Gray Danival, Phyllis Boyd, Rhonda Chapman, Samantha Horton, Sharon Clark, Shate Marsh, Stacia Murphy, Stephanie Robertson, Trish Williams, Taisha Ahmed, Uzuri Assad, Val Tate, Veronica Schwartz DeFazio, Viola Moten Ratcliffe, Yolanda Eccles, and Yvette Upton. Thank them.
Yes, thank you. Thank you to all those amazing women who've been part of this and put themselves out there like that. The other thing, a few people have wanted to connect to this project because of the timing. I mean, is the overturning of Roe versus Wade and you know, here in Indiana, starting September 15th, women will, you know, have lost the right to have control over that part of their reproduction. Let's talk about why the show is not about Roe versus Wade and not, you know, and not about this. And we have a bit already, but let's like bring that on home for people so they understand why it's not.
Well, to begin, the show began way before this happened. It just, the exhibition of it was in the creation of it and the exhibition of it from logistical matters was long before that happened. It just landed when this is happening. So we can call it kismet, we can call it whatever. But the reality is these things about healing and controlling one's own body. You know, looking at the memes and things, I'm always, they always want to run around, head, manes, tail, this and that. And really, that's a Eurocentric Western viewpoint about what even this is, because everything that is a part of that book, The Handmaid's Tale, has actually happened to Black women on these shores. Forced birthing, experimentation, all those things have happened and they continue to happen. And so to reduce this idea about healing these histories to just, it's just about abortion. No, it's not. For who? And so that really becomes a story that's just about walking into a space about Black women ultimately and what those history means. And don't get me wrong, white people are attached to those histories. And thus, again, from a Western viewpoint, it is, I mean, from a West African viewpoint, it is still white women's responsibility as those who own wombs. The womb is the place of transformation, period. And to transform what that means for white society is the role of white womb owners, period. With that being said, to suddenly say it's about Roe v. Wade, that is such a very small part of what it means to be a Black woman in this country running around with a womb. What it means to have had your ancestors be literally putting breeding farms to make baby after baby a year, to have Black men turn into bucks and their job is to create 12 babies a year, one a month. It doesn't matter who the woman is. And for that woman to, who wasn't a woman oftentimes, who was a girl, that from the moment of first menses being responsible for birthing, and that by the time she's 17 and things should have had two or three children, if not more, for her value and worth. So to reduce it down to Roe v. Wade is an insult to the whole idea that we're really looking at what is the context of those histories and what do they mean. Women have always found ways to get rid of babies that they don't want, period. Sometimes that means their life. For women of color, that means also not being forcibly sterilized to have the babies that you want. So to reduce it down to one thing and not to take on the complexity of what it means for brown women to walk into a black space, literally, and to not understand you're here to bear witness, but to center a thing that is really rooted in the way of rich white women, they're going to be okay. The majority of people who have to have this is because they're in situations that are horrible, or they just can't afford the child. That to root it a particular way because that's convenient. Yeah, we're not doing that. I'm not going to slap in the face all those ancestors of my family who've been here since the 1600s and all the things that it means that some of my relatives are as brown as me and some of them look like Shate. And there is a reason for that. And to not honor that because it's not politically convenient at this moment, I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. Those histories are hard. If you want to walk into those histories, then you walk into them. You don't boil them down to something that's convenient. That if we're going to talk about what does it mean to be a black woman in the U.S. giving birth, either way it goes, I can be effed. That's just the simple that I have a baby and my mortality rate is high, period. Because of systemic biases that mean I'm not going to get the proper care that I need.
Yeah.
So it's much more complicated. That's that IG me mentality that you can't walk in and be like, okay, maybe this is not about that. What is it? Let me explore. It becomes, no, I'm going to take it and we're going to do it. No, you're not taking anything because that's not what we're doing here.
Yeah.
You can choose to stand in the spirit of how do we heal these real horrible histories and that everything that gets attached to it, that we think about that 10-year-old girl, where I think about thousands and thousands of millions of enslaved girls that didn't have that option.
Yeah.
And some of them became our relatives. And yeah. The trauma that gets passed on generations later of what that means to be put in that situation where your virginity is taken against your will to make another baby and you yourself are still a baby. So,
yeah.
Hopefully that answers your question.
It
and maybe
does.
You can just like when people come in, just play. I'm gonna just play
here,
this part
let me
of it.
Play this.
Just
for you.
Play that. Mm-hmm. Just play that. And here's a couple of books for you right there.
So, let's talk about future projects. Which you brought one up, you know, at the mm-hmm. intro of this. You know, so after the sister song, we'll take a nap. You said, but what?
I am in the middle of rounding out the completion of a series that was actually a part of how Sister Song gets birthed, which is Keeper of My Mother's Dream. We had a part of that exhibit in 2017 was a piece called Becoming, which looks at, again, through West African traditions, using the ancestral masquerade as a way to heal these histories. Like, how do we evoke the ancestors that were around particular parts of history so they can actually support the living to heal those histories. And so the next three pieces in that, and you can go to my website and BitCar's website and actually see the a video about that exhibit, which shows the piece. The next three pieces are currently being made, and those are mother, healer, ancestor, that they are becoming sisters. And that's just what I call becoming uh-huh. sisters, uh-huh. Which I'm really excited about. So now that Sister Song is running flat out the gate now, back to sewing for becoming sisters. And looking at by the end of the year, first part of 2023, they'll be done and on exhibition. They are installations. So they're, you know, fortunately, when you start making installations, they start making themselves. And actually just before, you know, my favorite art store is the Goodwill. I'm going to be honest, when you have to have like little things for installations, not a Goodwill. And on my way here, I was like, oh, there's one that I haven't seen before. And swung over there and bought like four things. I was like, this is for mother and this is for ancestor. And I was like, stop it. And I'm like, no. So I'm really excited about those. And I think also that I found because as much as possible, I like things to exist in community. And I was really excited because I think I found a place for them to be, if not all together, at least 1 month here, 1 month there, so they could be like a sustained dialogue over a series of months with them. So I'm really excited. And they seemed excited about the notion of the work being there. So
that's awesome.
Now, keep your fingers crossed, but I'll tell you when it's done, where it's going.
Where can people, can you tell us your website? Where can people learn more about your work?
It's just my name, LashondaCrowStorm.com, LashaWnda, Crow, CROWE, Storm, STORM. So it's Lashonda Bird Rain. That's what I think about .com. And they can see the Keeper of My Mother's Dream project on there that has given birth to the next two projects, Sister Song, as well as Becoming and Her Sisters, which we're working on.
And Sister Song, the Requiem, is open through October 16th. You can learn more about the events that are connected to this exhibit at www.bigcar.org. LaShonda, is there anything you want to add before we wrap up? Is there anything I...
No, I just... Everybody support Big Car. They're one of the few places that actually create opportunities for artists, social practice artists, where the focus is not on how much we sell, but how much the artwork in itself be a vehicle for transformation and invite community into the space. Yeah, that's what I got.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, LaShonda.
Thank you.
All right. Well, and thank you to our listeners again. And thank you to the people that made this possible, the DeHaan Artist of Distinction Award, and Mr. and Mrs. Craigie Von Dalen and Laurel S. Judkins. So thank you.
Thank you.